community, a nation. The norms were created by somebody, and each of us is somebody. We can make our own normal. We can throw out all the rules and write our own. We can build our lives from the inside out. We can stop asking what the world wants from us and instead ask ourselves what we want for our world. We can stop looking at what's in front of us long enough to discover what's inside us. We can remember and unleash the life-changing, relationship-changing, world-changing power of our own imagination. It might take us a lifetime. Luckily, a lifetime is exactly how long we have. Let's conjure up, from the depths of our souls, the truest, most beautiful lives we can imagine, the truest, most beautiful families we can fathom, the truest, most beautiful world we can hope for. Let's put it all on paper. Let's look at what we've written and decide that these are not pipe dreams. These are our marching orders. These are the blueprints for our lives, our families, and the world. May the invisible order become visible. May our dreams become our plans. Let it burn. Key 4, build and burn. When we let ourselves feel, our inner self transforms. When we act upon our knowing and imagination, our outer worlds transform. Living from the worlds within us will change our outer worlds. Here's the rub. Destruction is essential to construction. If we want to build the new, we must be willing to let the old burn. We must be committed to holding on to nothing but the truth. We must decide that if the truth inside us can burn a belief, a family structure, a business, a religion, an industry, it should have become ashes yesterday. If we feel, know, and imagine, our lives, families, and world become truer versions of themselves. Eventually. But at first, it's very scary. Because once we feel, know, and dare to imagine more for ourselves, we cannot unfeel, unknow, or unimagine. There is no going back. We are launched into the abyss, the space between the not true enough life we're living and the truer one that exists only inside us. So we say, maybe it's safer to just stay here. Even if it's not true enough, maybe it's good enough. But good enough is what makes people drink too much and snark too much and become bitter and sick and live in quiet desperation until they lie on their deathbed and wonder, what kind of woman, relationship, family, world might I have created if I'd been braver? The building of the true and beautiful means the destruction of the good enough. Rebirth means death. Once a truer, more beautiful vision is born inside us, life is in the direction of that vision. Holding on to what is no longer true enough is not safe. It's the riskiest move because it is the certain death of everything that was meant to be. We are alive only to the degree to which we are willing to be annihilated. Our next life will always cost us this one. If we are truly alive, we are constantly losing who we just were, what we just built, what we just believed, what we just knew to be true. I have lost identities, beliefs, and relationships that it has hurt to lose. I have learned that when I live from my emotions, knowing, and imagination, I am always losing. What I lose is always what is no longer true enough so that I can take full hold of what is. For a long while, I contorted myself to live according to a set of old memos I'd been issued about how to become a successful woman and build a strong family, career, and faith. I thought those memos were universal truth, so I abandoned myself to honor them without even unearthing and examining them. When I finally pulled them out of my subconscious and looked hard at them, I learned that these memos had never been truth at all. Just my particular culture's arbitrary expectations. Hustling to comply with my memos, I was flying on autopilot, routed to a destination I never chose. So I took back the wheel. I quit abandoning myself to honor those memos. Instead, I abandoned the memos and began honoring myself. I began to live as a woman who never got the world's memos. I burned the memo that defined selflessness as the pinnacle of womanhood. But first, I forgave myself for believing that lie for so long. I had abandoned myself out of love. They'd convinced me that the best way for a woman to love her partners, family, and community was to lose herself in service to them. In my desire to be of service, I did myself and the world a great disservice. I've seen what happens out in the world and inside our relationships when women stay numb, obedient, quiet, and small. Selfless women make for an efficient society, but not a beautiful, true, or just one. When women lose themselves, the world loses its way. We do not need more selfless women. What we need right now is more women who have detoxed themselves so completely from the world's expectations that they are full of nothing but themselves. What we need are women who are full of themselves. A woman who is full of herself knows and trusts herself enough to say and do what must be done. She lets the rest burn. I burned the memo that responsible motherhood is martyrdom. I decided that the call of motherhood is to become a model, not a martyr. I unbecame a woman slowly dying in her children's name and became a responsible mother, one who shows her children how to be fully alive. I burned the memo insisting that the way a family avoids brokenness is to keep its structure by any means necessary. I noticed families clinging to their original structures that were very broken indeed. I noticed other families whose structures had shifted and were healthy and vibrant. I decided that a family's wholeness or brokenness has little to do with its structure. A broken family is any family that pledges allegiance to a prescribed structure above each member's full humanity. A broken family is a family in which any member must break herself into pieces to fit in. A whole family is one in which each member can bring her full self to the table, knowing that she will always be both held and free. I decided to let my family's form become an evolving ecosystem. I unbecame a woman clinging to a prescribed family structure and became one clinging to each of her family members' right to their full humanity, including me. We would break and re-break our structure instead of allowing any of us to live broken. I quit buying the idea that a successful marriage is one that lasts till death, even if one or both spouses are dying inside it. I decided that before I ever vowed myself to another person, I'd take this vow to myself. I'll not abandon myself. Not ever again. Me and myself, we are till death do us part. We'll forsake all others to remain whole. I unbecame a woman who believed that another would complete me when I decided that I was born complete. I let burn my cherished, comfortable idea of America as a place of liberty and justice for all. I let a truer, wider perspective be born in its place, one that included the American experience of people who don't look like me. I wrote myself a new memo about what it means to have strong faith. To me, faith is not a public allegiance to a set of outer beliefs, but a private surrender to the inner knowing. I stopped believing in middlemen or hierarchy between me and God. I went from certain and defensive to curious, wide-eyed and awed, from closed fists to open arms, from the shallow to the deep end. For me, living in faith means allowing to burn all that separates me from the knowing so that one day I can say, I and the mother are one. The memos I've written for myself are neither right nor wrong. They are just mine. They're written in sand so that I can revise them whenever I feel, know, imagine a truer, more beautiful idea for myself. I'll be revising them until I take my last breath. I am a human being meant to be in perpetual becoming. If I am living bravely, my entire life will become a million deaths and rebirths. My goal is not to remain the same, but to live in such a way that each day, year, moment, relationship, conversation, and crisis is the material I use to become a truer, more beautiful version of myself. The goal is to surrender constantly who I just was in order to become who this next moment calls me to be. I will not hold on to a single existing idea, opinion, identity, story, or relationship that keeps me from emerging new. I cannot hold too tightly to any riverbank. I must let go of the shore in order to travel deeper and see farther, again and again and then again, until the final death and rebirth, right up until then. Part 3, Free. Aches. I'm 13 years old and bulimic, so I spend half my life curling my bangs and the other half eating excessively and throwing up. Curling and hurling are not an acceptable life, so on Fridays after school, my mom drives me downtown to the therapist. She stays in the lobby and I walk in alone, sit down in a brown leather chair, and wait for the therapist to ask, "How are you today, Glennon?" I smile and say, "I'm fine. How are you today?" She breathes deeply with her whole body. Then we're quiet. I notice a picture of a small red-headed girl on my kind, frustrated therapist's desk. I ask who the girl is. She glances over, touches the frame, and says, "That's my daughter." When she turns back to me, her face is sad and soft. She says, "Glennon, you say you're fine, but you aren't. Your eating disorder could kill you. You know that. What you don't know is that since you refuse to feel all of this, since you won't join us in the land of the living, you're half dead already." I am offended. My insides turn hot and they feel instantly inflated, difficult to contain. I hold my breath and clench everything. Well, maybe I'm trying to be fine. Maybe all I do is try to be fine. Maybe I try harder than anybody. She says, "Maybe you should stop trying to be fine. Maybe life isn't fine and maybe it'll never be fine. Maybe fine isn't the right goal. What if you stopped trying so hard to be fine and just lived?" "I don't know what you're talking about," I say. I know exactly what she's talking about. She's talking about the ache. I don't know when I first discovered the ache, but by the time I'm 10 years old, it has become my constant interrupter. When my cat, Coco, climbs onto the couch with me, she rubs her face against mine so softly and she purrs so gently that I'm tempted to let myself melt into her. But the ache interrupts with, "Be careful, she won't live very long. You'll have to bury her soon." When my grandmother Alice whispers her evening rosary, I spy on her. She is the master of the universe, there in her rocker, controlling everything on earth, keeping me safe. Just as I become lulled into peace by the rocking, the ache points and says, "Look at how bruised and papery the skin on her hands is. See how they shake?" When my mom leans over to kiss me goodnight, I catch the smell of her face lotion. I feel the soft sheets under me and the warm blanket around me, and I breathe in deeply. I rarely make it to the exhale in peace, though. The ache paralyzes me with, "You know how this ends. When she goes, you will not survive." I don't know if the ache is trying to protect me or terrorize me. I don't know if it loves me or hates me, if it's bad or good. I just know that its role is to constantly remind me of the most essential fact of life, which is, this ends. Don't get too attached to anything. So when I get too soft, too comforted, too close to love, the ache reminds me. It always arrives in words, "She'll die," or an image, a phone call, a funeral, and immediately my body responds. I stiffen, hold my breath, straighten my spine, break eye contact, lean away. After that, I'm in control again. The ache keeps me prepared, distant, safe. The ache keeps me fine, which is another word for half dead. It takes a lot of effort for a live human being to stay half dead. For me, it also takes a lot of food. When I discover binging and purging at 10, food addiction becomes a whole life I can lead that has utterly nothing to do with actual life. Bulimia keeps me busy, distant, distracted. I plan my next binge all day, and when I find a private place to start eating, my frenzy becomes a raging waterfall inside and outside me, loud, much too loud for any interruption at all. There's no remembering, no ache, nothing but the binge. Then, just as I'm stuffed to the point of more nothingness, the purge. Another waterfall, more noise, nothing but noise until I'm on the floor, laid out, racked, too tired to feel or think or remember anything at all. Perfect. Bulimia is private. I need a way to silence the ache in public, too. That's what booze is for. Booze overpowers the ache. Instead of just interrupting love, it blocks it completely. No connection is real, so there is nothing risky for the ache to bother interrupting. Over the years, I learned that the bonus of booze is that it destroys all of my relationships before I can. You can't lose people who never even found you. By the time I turn 25, I have been arrested repeatedly. I cough up blood on a regular basis. My family has distanced themselves from me for their own protection. I have no feelings left, and I am nowhere near the land of the living, which is for fools and masochists. I am no fool. I have beaten life at its own game. I have learned how to exist without living at all, and I am completely free with nothing left to lose. I am also almost dead, but by God, I am safe. Take that, life. And then, that May morning, I find myself staring at that positive pregnancy test. I am certainly surprised by the pregnancy, but I'm absolutely stunned by my reaction to it. I feel inside me a deep desire to grow and birth and raise a person. These thoughts are foreign and baffling. I stand up and stare at my puffy, dirty face in the mirror and think, hold up. Wait. What, you there in the mirror? You don't even like life. You don't even find it worth trying yourself. Why, then, are you suddenly desperate to bestow life upon another being as though it's some kind of gift? The only answer I have is, because I love it already. I want life for this being because I love this being. Why don't I want life for myself, then? I want to be a being that I love, too. The ache sweeps in with a ferocity. Danger, danger, don't be ridiculous. It becomes difficult to breathe. Yet there in that bathroom, dirty, sick, broken, aching, gasping, I still want to become a mother. That is how I learn that there is something deeper and truer and more powerful inside me than the ache. Because the deeper thing wins. The deeper thing is my desire to become a mother. This is what I want more than I want to stay safe. I want to be this being's mother. I decide right there on the floor to get sober and re-enter the land of the living. I suspect that the courage I muster up to make this decision is due, in large part, to the fact that I'm still wasted from the night before. I stand up and wobble out of the bathroom and into life. Life is exactly as I remembered it. Just the fucking worst. While I attempt to both become a human and grow a human at the exact same ridiculous time, I am also teaching third grade. By noon each day, I am dizzy with several sicknesses at once: morning sickness, withdrawal sickness, and the sickness of living without a daily escape plan. Each day at noon, I walk my class the long way to lunch so I can peek into my friend Josie's classroom and see the sign hung above her window, which says in big black block letters, "We can do hard things." "We can do hard things" becomes my hourly life mantra. It is my affirmation that living life on life's own absurd terms is hard. It isn't hard because I'm weak or flawed or because I made a wrong turn somewhere. It is hard because life is just hard for humans, and I am a human who is finally doing life right. We Can Do Hard Things insists that I can and should stay in the hard because there is some kind of reward for staying. I don't know what the reward is yet, but it feels true that there would be one, and I want to find out what it is. I am especially comforted by the we part. I don't know who the we is. I just need to believe that there is a we somewhere, either helping me through my hard things or doing their own hard things while I do mine. This is how I survive early sobriety, which turns out to be one long return of the ache. I say to myself every few minutes, this is hard. We can do hard things. And then I do them. Fast forward 10 years. I have 3 children, a husband, a house, and a big career as a writer. I'm not just a sober, upstanding citizen. I'm kind of fancy, honestly. I am, by all accounts, humaning successfully. At a book signing during that time, a reporter approaches my father, points toward the long line of people waiting to meet me, and says, "You must be so proud of your daughter." My father looks at the reporter and says, "Honestly, we're just happy she's not in jail." We are all so happy I'm not in jail. One morning, I am in my closet getting dressed when my phone rings. I answer. It's my sister. She is speaking slowly and deliberately because she is between contractions. She says, "It's time, Sissy. The baby's coming. Can you fly to Virginia now?" I say, "Yes, I can. I will come. I will be there soon." Then I hang up and stare at a large stack of jeans on my shelf. I am unsure of what to do next. During the past decade, I have learned how to do many hard things, but I still don't know how to do easy things, like book a flight. My sister usually does easy things for me. I think and decide that it is perhaps a less than ideal time to call her back and ask if she's aware of any good airline deals. I think some more and begin to wonder if anyone else's sister might be available to help me. Then the phone rings again. This time it's my mom. Her voice is slow and deliberate too. She says, "Honey, you need to come to Ohio right away. It's time to say goodbye to Grandma." I say nothing. She says, "Honey, are you there? Are you okay? How are you today, Glennon?" I'm still in my closet staring at my jeans. That's what I remember thinking first. I have a lot of jeans. Then, the ache becomes real and knocks on my door. My Grandma Alice is dying. I am being called to fly toward the dying. "How are you today, Glennon?" I do not say, "I'm fine, Mom." I say, "I'm not okay, but I'm coming. I love you." I hang up, walk to my computer, and Google how to buy plane tickets. I accidentally buy 3 tickets, but I'm still proud of myself. I walk back into my closet and begin to pack. I am both packing and watching myself pack, and my watching self is saying, "Wow, look at you. You are doing it. You look like a grown-up. Don't stop. Don't think. Just keep moving. We can do hard things." Surprisingly, now that the ache has transformed from idea to reality, I feel relatively steady. Dealing with the drop shoe is less paralyzing, apparently, than waiting for that shoe to drop. I call my sister and tell her I have to go to Ohio first. She already knows. My mom picks me up at the Cleveland airport and drives me to the retirement home. We are quiet and soft with each other. No one says she's fine. We arrive and walk through the loud lobby, then through the antiseptic-smelling hallway, and into my grandmother's warm, dark, Catholic room. I pass her motorized wheelchair and notice the gray duct tape covering the high-speed button, which she has lost her right to use because her hallway velocity has been scaring the other residents. I sit down in the chair next to my grandmother's bed. I touch the Mary statue on her bedside table, then the deep blue glass rosary beads draped over Mary's hands. I peek behind the table and see a small calendar hung there, the theme of which is hot priests. Each month's priest wears a full vestment and a smoldering smile. This calendar is a fundraiser for something or other. Charity has always been important to my grandmother. My mother stands several feet behind me, giving my grandmother and me time and space. I have never in my life felt the ache more deeply than I do in that moment, as my mother stands behind me, watching me touch each of her mother's things, knowing exactly which memory I am recalling with each lingering touch, knowing that her daughter is preparing to say goodbye to her mother, and that her mother is preparing to say goodbye to her daughter. My grandmother reaches over, rests her hand on mine, and looks at me deeply. This is when the ache becomes too powerful to resist. I am out of practice. I don't stiffen. I don't hold my breath. I don't break eye contact. I unclench and let it take me. First, it takes me to the thought that one day, not long after this, these roles will shift. I will be in my mother's place, watching my daughter say goodbye to my mother. Then, not too long from then, it will be my daughter watching her daughter say goodbye to me. I think these thoughts. I see these visions. I feel them too. They are hard and deep. The ache continues to take me with it, and now I am somewhere else. I am in the ache. I am in the one big ache of love, pain, beauty, tenderness, longing, goodbye, and I am here with my grandmother and my mother, and suddenly I understand that I am here with everyone else too. Somehow I am here with everyone who has ever lived and ever loved and ever lost. I have entered the place I thought was death, and it has turned out to be life itself. I entered this ache alone, but inside it I have found everyone. In surrendering to the ache of loneliness, I have discovered unloneliness. Right here, inside the ache, with everyone who has ever welcomed a child or held the hand of a dying grandmother or said goodbye to a great love, I am here with all of them. Here is the we that I recognized in Josie's sign. Inside the ache is the we. We can do hard things, like be alive and love deep and lose it all, because we do these things alongside everyone who has ever walked the earth with her eyes, arms, and heart wide open. The ache is not a flaw. The ache is our meeting place. It's the clubhouse of the brave. All the lovers are there. It is where you go alone to meet the world. The ache is love. The ache was never warning me, this ends, so leave. She was saying, this ends, so stay. I stayed. I held my grandmother Alice Flaherty's paper hands. I touched the wedding rings she still wore 26 years after my grandfather's death. I love you, honey, she said. I love you too, Grandma, I said. Take care of that baby for me, she said. That was it. I did not say anything remarkable at all. It turns out that a lot of goodbye is done in the touching of things, rosaries, hands, memories, love. I kissed my grandmother, felt her warm, soft forehead with my lips. Then I stood up and walked out of the room. My mother followed me. She shut the door behind us and we stood in the hallway and held each other and shook. We had taken a great journey together to the place where brave people go, and it had changed us. My mom drove me back to the airport. I boarded another plane to Virginia. My dad picked me up and we drove to the birthing center. I walked into my sister's room and she looked over at me from her bed. Then she looked down at the bundle in her arms and up at me again. She said, "Sister, meet your niece, Alice Flaherty." I took baby Alice into my arms and we sat down in the rocking chair next to my sister's bed. First, I touched Alice Flaherty's hands, purple and papery. Next, I noticed her gray blue eyes, which stared right into mine. They looked like the eyes of the master of the universe. They said to me, "Hello, here I am. Life goes on." Since I got sober, I have never been fine again, not for a single moment. I have been exhausted and terrified and angry. I have been overwhelmed and underwhelmed and debilitatingly depressed and anxious. I have been amazed and awed and delighted and overjoyed to bursting. I have been reminded constantly by the ache, "This will pass. Stay close." I have been alive. Ghosts. I was born a little broken, with an extra dose of sensitivity. Some horseshit I wrote about myself in my first memoir. When I was in my 20s, I believed that somewhere there existed a perfect human woman. She woke up beautiful, unbloated, clear-skinned, fluffy-haired, fearless, lucky in love, calm, and confident. Her life was easy. She haunted me like a ghost. I tried so hard to be her. In my 30s, I gave that ghost the finger. I quit trying to be the perfect woman and decided to celebrate my imperfection. I claimed a new identity, jacked up human. I announced to anyone who would listen, "I'm a hot mess and proud of it. I love this crappy version of humanity that I am. I am broken and beautiful. F you, perfect woman." The problem was that I still believed that there was an ideal human and that I was not her. The problem was that I still believed in ghosts. I had just decided to live in defiance of perfection instead of in pursuit of it. Rebellion is as much of a cage as obedience is. They both mean living in reaction to someone else's way instead of forging your own. Freedom is not being for or against an idea, but creating your own from scratch. A few years ago, Oprah Winfrey was interviewing me about my first memoir. She opened the book and read my words back to me. "I was born a little broken." Then she paused, looked up from the page, and asked, "Would you still describe yourself that way? As broken?" Her eyes sparkled. I looked at her and said, "No, actually, I wouldn't. That's ridiculous. I think this sort of thing is why Jesus only wrote in the sand. Broken means does not function as it was designed to function. A broken human is one who does not function the way humans are designed to function. When I think about my own human experience, what honest people have told me about their human experiences, and the experiences of every historical and contemporary human being I've ever studied, we all seem to function in the exact same way. We hurt people, and we are hurt by people. We feel left out, envious, not good enough, sick, and tired. We have unrealized dreams and deep regrets. We are certain that we were meant for more and that we don't even deserve what we have. We feel ecstatic and then numb. We wish our parents had done better by us. We wish we could do better by our children. We betray and we are betrayed. We lie and we are lied to. We say goodbye to animals, to places, to people we cannot live without. We are so afraid of dying, also of living. We have fallen in love and out of love, and people have fallen in love and out of love with us. We wonder if what happened to us that night will mean we can never be touched again without fear. We live with rage bubbling. We are sweaty, bloated, gassy, oily. We love our children. We long for children. We do not want children. We are at war with our bodies, our minds, our souls. We are at war with one another. We wish we'd said all those things while they were still here. They're still here, and we're still not saying those things. We know we won't. We don't understand ourselves. We don't understand why we hurt those we love. We want to be forgiven. We cannot forgive. We don't understand God. We believe. We absolutely do not believe. We are lonely. We want to be left alone. We want to belong. We want to be loved. We want to be loved. We want to be loved. If this is our shared human experience, where did we get the idea that there is some other, better, more perfect, unbroken way to be human? Where is the human being who is functioning correctly, against whom we are all judging our performances? Who is she? Where is she? What is her life if it is not these things? I got free the moment I realized that my problem isn't that I'm not a good enough human. My problem is that I'm not a good enough ghost. Since I don't have to be a ghost, I don't have a problem. If you are uncomfortable, in deep pain, angry, yearning, confused, you don't have a problem. You have a life. Being human is not hard because you're doing it wrong. It's hard because you're doing it right. You will never change the fact that being human is hard, so you must change your idea that it was ever supposed to be easy. I will not call myself broken, flawed, or imperfect anymore. I will quit chasing ghosts because the chase left me weary, and because I am a woman who no longer believes in ghosts. Allow me to rewrite my own self-description. I am 44 years old. With all my chin hairs and pain and contradictions, I am flawless, unbroken. There is no other way. I am haunted by nothing. Smiles. Two Christmases ago, my sister and I presented our parents with a check to buy themselves a trip to Paris. They were so touched and proud that they framed the check, uncashed, and hung it on their living room wall. This year we doubled down. We bought 4 plane tickets to Paris and decided to hand deliver our parents to the city they had always wanted to visit. We stayed in a tiny apartment overlooking the Eiffel Tower. I had never been to Europe before. I was charmed. Paris is elegant and old. Being there made me feel elegant and young. It helped me forgive America for our arrogance and fury. In Paris, surrounded by ruins of ancient baths, guillotines, and churches more than 1,000 years old, humanity's mistakes and beauty are unfurled like a mural. In America, we are so new. We still fancy ourselves conquerors and renegades. We're all still trying to be the firsts to do this or that. Can you imagine? We are all competing for our parents' attention, and we have no parents. It makes us a little jumpy. Paris is not jumpy. Paris is calm and certain. It's not going to startle easily, and it already knows the words to all the songs. Everywhere I looked in Paris, I found proof that leaders come and go, buildings are built and fall, revolutions begin and end, nothing, no matter how grand, lasts. Paris says, "We are here for such a short time. We might as well sit down for a long while with some good coffee, company, and bread." There is more time for being human there. Maybe because there has just been more time to learn how. When we visited the Louvre, we entered the Mona Lisa room and found a crowd of hundreds pushing, jostling, selfieing all around her. I stared from a distance, trying to appreciate her. I really didn't understand what all the fuss was about. I wondered if all the jostling people understood or if they were just acting like they did. A woman walked over and stood next to me. She said, "You know, there's a theory about her smile. Want to hear it?" "Yes, please," I said. Mona Lisa and her husband lost a baby. Sometime later, her husband commissioned this painting from Da Vinci to celebrate the birth of another baby. Mona Lisa sat for Leonardo to paint her, but she wouldn't smile during the sitting. Not all the way. The story goes that Da Vinci wanted her to smile wider, but she refused. She did not want the joy she felt for her new baby to erase the pain she felt from losing the first. There in her half smile is her half joy. Or maybe it's her full joy and her full grief all at the same time. She has the look of a woman who has just realized a dream but still carries the lost dream inside her. She wanted her whole life to be present on her face. She wanted everyone to remember, so she wouldn't pretend. Now I understand what the fuss is all about. Mona Lisa is the patron saint of honest, resolute, fully human women, women who feel and who know. She is saying for us, don't tell me to smile. I will not be pleasant. Even trapped here, inside two dimensions, you will see the truth. You will see my life's brutal and beautiful right here on my face. The world will not be able to stop staring. Goals. When I got pregnant with Chase and quit drinking, drugging, and purging, I thought it might be my last chance to stop being bad and start being good. I married Chase's father, and I learned to cook and clean and fake orgasms. I was a good wife. I had three babies and put all their needs so far ahead of my own that I forgot I had needs at all. I was a good mom. I started going to church and learned to fear God and not ask too many questions of folks who claimed to represent God. I was a good Christian. I watched beauty trends carefully, and I dyed my hair and paid to get poison injected into my forehead so I wouldn't look too tired from all the effort it takes to be good at beauty. I started writing and released bestsellers and spoke to sold-out audiences all over the country. A woman isn't allowed to do well unless she also does good, so I became a do-gooder for the world. I raised tens of millions of dollars for people who were hurting, and I lost a decade of sleep writing back to strangers. You are a good woman, Glennon, they said. I was. I was so good. I was also exhausted, anxious, and lost. I assumed that was because I wasn't good enough yet. I just had to try a little harder. My husband's infidelity was a jagged gift because it forced me to see that being a good wife wasn't enough to keep my marriage together. Being a good mother wasn't enough to keep my kids from pain. Being a good world saver wasn't enough to save my own world. Being bad had almost killed me, but so had being good. I was talking to a dear friend around that time. She said, "Gee, remember that amazing Steinbeck quote? And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good." I've kept it on my desk for years. I looked at it last night and thought, I'm tired of being good. I'm so tired. Let's change it to, and now that we don't have to be good, we can be free. Adam and Keys. A few years ago, Alicia Keys announced to the world that she was done wearing makeup. She said, "I don't want to cover up anymore. Not my face, not my mind, not my soul, not my thoughts, not my dreams, not my struggles, nothing." That's it, I thought. A while later, I read an interview with Adam Levine. He said that while they were filming a show together, he poked his head into Alicia Keys' dressing room. She had her back to him, and she was leaning into the mirror, putting on lipstick. He smiled and said, "Oh, I thought Alicia doesn't wear makeup." She turned around, looked at him, lipstick in her hand. She said, "I do what the fuck I want." That's it. Ears. My daughters are different. I raised Tish while I was still trying to be a good parent, but then I got tired. By the time Emma exited the birth canal, I'd just handed her an iPad and wished the child Godspeed on her journey. One way to describe Emma is independent. Another is on her own. This parenting approach, retreat, has served her well. She wears what she wants and says what she wants, and mostly she does what she wants. She has created herself, and she is a glorious invention with which she is well pleased. Recently, we were sitting around the kitchen table, and Tish mentioned her need to train more if she ever hoped to be great at soccer. We asked Emma if she felt the same way. Emma took a bite of her pizza and said, "Nah, I'm already great." She is 12. Maybe 11, actually. I have 3 children, and their ages change every single year. All I know is they are in the phase that comes after crawling but before college, somewhere in that sweet spot. Years ago, when I was in the thick of deciding whether I wanted to save or end my marriage, the girls began begging to get their ears pierced. I was grateful for the distraction, so I said yes. I took them to the mall, and when we arrived at the piercing kiosk, Emma ran ahead of me, leaped into the piercing chair, and announced to the surprised 20-something piercer, "Let's do this." When I finally caught up, the piercer turned to me and said, "Are you her mother?" "I am trying to be," I said. "Okay, do you want me to pierce her ears one at a time or both at the same time?" Emma said, "Both. Do it. Let's go." Then she squinted her eyes, gritted her teeth, and flexed all her muscles like a tiny Hulk. As they pierced her, I saw a couple of tears that she wiped away immediately. I looked at Emma and thought, she is so awesome. She is also 6 years from a felony. She jumped down from the chair, buzzing with adrenaline. The women working at the kiosk laughed and said, "Wow, she is so brave." Tish stood next to me, taking all of it in. She motioned for me to lean down closer. She whispered, "Actually, Mom, I changed my mind. I don't want to get my ears pierced today." "Are you sure?" I asked. She looked over at Emma's earlobes, swollen grape tomatoes. Emma said, "Come on, Tish, you only live once." Tish said, "Why does everyone say that when they're about to do dangerous things? How about you only live once, so don't get dead early?" Then she looked back at me and said, "I'm sure." The piercer turned to Tish and said, "Your turn, honey." I waited for Tish to speak. She said, "No, thank you. I'm not ready today." The piercer said, "Oh, come on. You can do it. Be brave. Look how brave your little sister was." Tish looked at me, and I squeezed her hand as we walked away. She felt a little ashamed, and I felt a lot annoyed. I don't think brave means what we've been saying it means. We tell our children that brave means feeling afraid and doing it anyway, but is this the definition we want them to carry as they grow older? When she is 17, headed out in a car driven by her teenage buddy, saying she's going to the movies but actually going to that kegger down the street, imagine calling to her, "Bye, babe, be brave tonight." What I mean by that is, if you're in a scary situation and you feel afraid to do what your friends are encouraging you to do, I want you to ignore that fear and do it anyway. Just plow right through that gut instinct of yours. No. That is not the understanding of being brave I want my children to have. I do not want my children to become people who abandon themselves to please the crowd. Brave does not mean feeling afraid and doing it anyway. Brave means living from the inside out. Brave means, in every uncertain moment, turning inward, feeling for the knowing, and speaking it out loud. Since the knowing is specific, personal, and ever-changing, so is brave. Whether you are brave or not cannot be judged by people on the outside. Sometimes being brave requires letting the crowd think you're a coward. Sometimes being brave means letting everyone down but yourself. Emma's brave is often loud and go for it. Tish's brave is often quiet and wait for it. They are both brave girls because each is true to herself. They are not divided between what they feel and know on the inside and what they say and do on the outside. Their selves are integrated. They have integrity. Tish showed tremendous bravery that day because keeping her integrity required her to resist the pressure of the crowd. She trusted her own voice more than she trusted the voices of others. Brave is not asking the crowd what is brave. Brave is deciding for oneself. On the way home from the mall, I said, "Tish, I know that lady made you feel unbrave today. People have different ideas about what's brave. You did the brave thing, because the brave thing is doing what your knowing tells you to do. You don't ask others what's brave. You feel and know what's brave. What you know to do might be the opposite of what others are telling you to do. It takes special bravery to honor yourself when the crowd is pressuring you not to. It it's easier just to give in. You didn't give in to the crowd today. You stood strong in what you felt and knew. To me, that's the greatest bravery. That's true confidence, which means loyalty to self. That's what you move through the world with, Tish, confidence. Regardless of what others are calling brave at the moment, you stay loyal to yourself. If you keep living with confidence, the rest of your life will unfold exactly as it should. It won't always be comfortable. Some will recognize you're brave, others won't. Some will understand and like you, others won't. But the way others respond to your confidence is not your business. Your business is to stay loyal to you. That way, you will always know that those who do like and love you are really your people. You'll never be forced to hide or act in order to keep people if you don't hide or act to get them. To be brave is to forsake all others, to be true to yourself. That is the vow of a confident girl. Terms. I met Liz at an airport. We were speaking at the same event somewhere out west. I flew all night to get there and then found myself in a small terminal, standing outside a circle made up of other speakers waiting to be picked up and delivered to the event. I hate how people stand in circles. I wish we'd all agree to stand around in horseshoes with room available for awkward outsiders to join. A woman walked over from baggage claim and stood next to me. I smiled and stayed quiet, which is my strategy for making it through. She smiled back, but her smile was different from mine. My smile says, "Hello, I am warm, polite, and unavailable." I smile like a period. Liz smiles slowly and openly, like a question mark. "Hi, I'm Liz." "I know," I said. "I adore your work. I'm Glennon." "Oh my gosh, I know you. I adore your work too. Where are you from?" "I live in Naples, Florida." "What's it like to live there?" "It's slow. It's a retirement city. I'd say the average age in my neighborhood is 80. The cool thing is that most of my friends are turning 40 and worried about starting to look old. Not me. I feel fantastic. Like a spring chicken. I go to the gym, look around at all the grandparents, and think, actually, I don't need to work out after all. I look amazing. It's all perspective, right? I tell my friends to skip the Botox and just move to Naples." Liz says, "Wonderful. How did you end up there?" "I got neurological Lyme disease a few years ago. My entire body shut down and I was in bed for 2 years and popping 50 pills a day. I went to stay in my friend's place in Naples and I felt so much better. I moved there temporarily and I was able to ditch the pills, so I just stayed. I've always known I wanted to live by the beach. I guess women have to almost die before we give ourselves permission to live how we want." Liz put her hand on my arm and said, "Wait, wow. That last thing you said about having to almost die, can you say that again?" I said, "I don't think so. I'm a little nervous. I have no idea what I just said." She smiled and said, "I like you. I like you too." The next night, along with everyone else at the convention, I went to see Liz speak. I got to the event early and claimed a seat in the front, but off to the side, close enough to see her clearly, but not close enough for her to see me clearly. She was standing behind the podium, wearing a black shirt with a high white collar, and she reminded me of a priest at a pulpit. When she started speaking, I found myself holding my breath. She spoke with gentleness and authority. A man in the front row kept talking to the woman beside him, and Liz paused mid-sentence, turned to him, and asked him to stop talking. He did. Something about the way she spoke, the way she carried herself, made my heart beat quicker than usual. She seemed certain, steady, free, relaxed. She was not complying and she was not rebelling. She was creating something new. She was original. I wanted to ask, can you say all that again? The next night, all the speakers attended a fancy banquet in a ski lodge at the top of a mountain. Snow was flurrying outside the floor-to-ceiling windows, and people were flurrying inside, trying to figure out where to stand and who was important enough to talk to. I saw Liz in a corner across the room, surrounded. My general policy is to honor people I admire by leaving them alone. I didn't that night. I walked over to her, and when she saw me, she smiled like another beginning. I drew closer, joined the huddle. The entire circle was pressing Liz with questions and requests for advice like she was a vending machine. I wanted to step on their toes. After a while, the host of the event walked over and said to Liz, "It's time to take our seats for dinner. May I lead you to your table?" Liz pointed to me and asked, "Can I sit with my friend?" The woman looked nervous, then apologetic. "I'm sorry, we've promised the donors that you'd sit with them." "Okay," she said. She looked forlorn. She squeezed my arm and said, "I'll miss you." During the dinner, I thought about how much I liked Liz and how sad it was that we wouldn't actually be able to be friends. Attempting to be her friend would be like intentionally writing a bad check. I am not a good friend. I have never been capable of or willing to commit to the maintenance that the rules of friendship dictate. I cannot remember birthdays. I do not want to meet for coffee. I will not host the baby shower. I won't text back because it's an eternal game of ping pong, the text